The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is. Cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm Rochelle Saunders, standing in again for regular host Desiree Shell, and this is the second of our two-part series on mathematics. Last week, we spoke with applied mathematician Malcolm Roberts, and this week we're switching gears and talking about pure math, where we'll be digging into the foundations of mathematics itself. Today I'm joined by Ian Stewart, mathematician and professor of mathematics at the University of Warwick in the UK. In addition to having written a mountain of academic papers and several textbooks, Ian has also penned over 24 books on science and math topics, from chaos theory, symmetry, math and biology, and even on the history of math itself. Some of his titles include Taming the Infinite, The Story of Mathematics from First Numbers to Chaos Theory, The Collapse of Chaos, and his newest book, In Pursuit of the Unknown, 17 Equations That Changed the World. He has won both the Christopher Zeeman Medal and the Michael Faraday Medal for his work in promoting and communicating mathematics. Welcome to the show, Ian.
Thank you for inviting me to take part, Rochelle.
So last week we spoke with an applied mathematician here in Canada about his work in the area of fluid dynamics, but also about applied mathematics in general. As a pure mathematician, what would you say the difference is between applied math and pure math?
I think it's a difference in attitude to some extent by the people doing it. If you actually look at the sort of the whole of mathematics, you can't easily divide it into two pieces and say that bit's pure, that bit's applied. There's a lot of stuff where they overlap. But I think the pure mathematician is mainly interested in problems because they come up within mathematics, because the mathematics itself says this is an interesting problem to solve. If we can't solve this problem, then we're going to get stuck in some interesting area. Whereas the applied mathematician is much more driven by trying to solve real-world problems, as the name suggests. They take a problem from, it could be physics, it could be astronomy, it could be biology, it could be, these days, it could be finance, and construct mathematical models and then use mathematical techniques on those models.
So what was the draw into pure mathematics for you as a student?
From about the age of 15 or so, it was becoming clear to me that being a mathematician was really what I wanted to do. I was very interested in the subject. I used to get hold of every math book I could find in the local library, and a friend of mine and I used to take the train up to London and buy math books. If you have that kind of mind, and I'm aware that a lot of people don't, and I quite understand why, but if you do have that kind of mind, it's a fascinating subject because everything fits together so nicely, and you can prove that certain rather strange things happen, and you think, oh, that's interesting, I wouldn't have expected that.
So I recently finished reading your book Taming the Infinite, which was actually given to me by a mathematician I know as a good sort of overview of mathematics. And one of the things I found really interesting was how frequently pure math with seemingly no practical use eventually finds real-world applications, sometimes hundreds of years later.
I always say to people, you know, the photocopying machine actually took about 100 years to go from the first idea to a practical photocopier that sat on people's desks. So it's not just math that has this problem, even in engineering. The fax machine also, the Victorians got the idea of a fax machine, but they didn't have our electronics and they couldn't really make it work properly. But I think in math this is particularly common, that something hangs around for 100 years or more and everyone looks at it and says, well, we're never going to get any applications of that. That's never going to be any use in the real world. And then one day you wake up and discover, hang on, they're using it. An example is number theory. This is the mathematics of whole numbers. And for about 2,400 years, that stuff was being done by the pure mathematicians only, because nobody could really see what it was going to be good for. And one of the great pure mathematicians, G.H. Hardy, an English mathematician at Cambridge, actually said at one point he was delighted to be working in number theory, because he actually he wasn't greatly in favor of applying mathematics, because one of the things people applied it to was war, and he was very anti-war. Well, it turns out that his beloved pure mathematical number theory is absolutely crucial nowadays to secure codes for sending information over the internet. It's used by the military for cryptography, for codes. We're in the digital age, and suddenly number theory has become much more important because it relates rather more directly to a lot of things that computers do or can do.
So your brand new book, In Pursuit of the Unknown, 17 Equations That Changed the World, does it actually talk about some of the mathematics that had to steep for a while before we found some practical uses for it?
Yes, it does. One, for example, Fourier analysis, it's called. So you go back to the middle of the 1800s, and Joseph Fourier, who is a Frenchman, is very interested in the flow of heat. And you think, well, that's a practical problem, isn't it? You know, steel mills and whatever. But actually, he was interested in the flow of heat almost just as a mathematical game. So the kind of problems he solved were not actually practical problems about heat flow. But he introduced a wonderful method, which is called Fourier analysis, which takes a very complicated waveform, some sort of mathematical shape, and represents it as a lot of very simple waveforms superimposed on each other. And these are the sine curves and cosine curves that we meet in trigonometry. So every mathematical function is a combination of sine curves and cosine curves. This is what Fourier discovers. Now, it took a while before anybody found real practical uses for this, but engineers now use it for problems like understanding how a building will shake in an earthquake. You Fourier analyze the building and you find which frequencies of vibration are particularly dangerous. They're the ones where it will vibrate with a big amplitude. It will move a lot. And then you look at earthquakes and see whether those kind of frequencies are likely. And you design the building to make sure that its natural frequency of vibration is different from the earthquake vibrations that it's likely to be exposed to. Another application, totally different. If you take a photo on a digital camera, then certainly until fairly recently, it was probably coded as a JPEG file. It's sort of the .jpg that you see on your camera when you play around with the files in it.
Right.
Now, that's a method for compressing the amount of information that is needed to specify your photograph. So that means that you can get something like 10 times as many photos on a memory card as you would otherwise be able to if you didn't compress them. Now, that compression technique, it actually involves five separate mathematical steps, but the most important one, the one that is sort of key to the whole thing, is a Fourier transform of the image itself. So this stuff was hanging around for 100 years or so, and it is now probably, it's certainly a candidate for the most useful piece of mathematics that anyone has ever done.
That's amazing that sometimes all it takes is just time, and it's sitting there.
It's sort of simmering. It's on the back burner. People are getting used to it. People are starting to work out the implications. And, of course, the background of what is important for human beings is changing all the time. The kind of questions that we ask now are different from the sort of questions we would have been asking 100 years ago. At one point, the mathematics of zeppelins, of big giant balloons, was very, very important. This is how people traveled around by air. Well, the mathematics of zeppelins is not actually a very important subject anymore.
So there was a lot of really fascinating history in taming the infinite, including the different number systems and counting systems that some of the ancient cultures used. Even something like our base 10 counting system, which we now take for granted, actually hasn't been around for all that long. I believe the ancient Babylonians used a base 60 number system.
Well, the Babylonians were very, very interested in astronomy, and the year is divided into 360 days plus a bit, I mean 365 and a quarter. But 360 was quite a nice number for them, and that's basically 60 times 6. And at some point, somebody must have decided that base 60 was good and that the 6 could kind of be fudged because you could easily divide things by 10 or whatever. And so we have 60 seconds in a minute, 60 minutes in an hour. We have 360 degrees in the circle. All of this comes from the Babylonians, and it's related to their interest. They based the whole number system on 60. The great thing with 60 is that 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 10, and 12, and 15 all divided. So a lot of fractions are much simpler in base 60.
I've actually heard that sometimes base 10 isn't the greatest base, just because 10 isn't as divisible by as many things.
The one that really causes trouble in base 10 is 1/3.
Right.
Which is 0.333333, and it has to go on forever.
Right.
Right, whereas in Babylonian, 1/3 would be, it's 20/60.
Right.
So it would just be their symbol for 20, and then that's it. So they were quite bright.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking with Rochelle Saunders, and we're talking about the history and foundations of math with mathematician and professor Ian Stewart. I never really thought before that things like fractions, decimals, and even the number zero had to be sort of invented. They're so ubiquitous now, but at one time they must have been really cutting-edge mathematics.
That's right. Zero, for example, zero would seem to be invented about three times. The Babylonians, in fact, and we're going back here well over 3,000 years, and they did at one point, fairly late in Babylonian history, they came up with a symbol for zero, because it's the same problem we have. If you don't have a symbol for zero and you're using some sort of mathematical notation where the position of the symbol tells you what it means, if I write down 2, 5, we know that's 25. But if we didn't have a symbol for zero, it might be 205, but the zero was missing. It might be 2,500. Putting the zero in helps to sort the whole thing out, and you know exactly what value each of the numbers is. Now, the Babylonians had that problem, and eventually they solved it in the same way. They would put a little symbol for zero. And then later on, the Indians also invented it. But it took several hundred years for the idea to really sink in. Fractions. The Babylonians didn't really do fractions the way we would. They wouldn't do 4 divided by 7 is 4/7.
Mm-hmm.
They would write it like a decimal, but in their base 60 notation.
Okay.
We will talk about numbers like 0.14182763 or whatever. And the Babylonians did the same thing, but they had a lot more symbols because they had 60 different digits, so to speak.
Right.
But that's how they handle fractions. Whereas if you go to the ancient Egyptians, they have a totally different way of doing fractions. But, well, in fact, they have two different systems. But the one that's most fascinating is they have symbols for 1 divided by something, 1/2, 1/3, 1/4, 1/5, 1/6, and so on. And then any other fraction they make by adding together. So 2/3 would be 1/2 plus 1/6 in ancient Egyptian.
Interesting.
And they would write it that way. And there's a whole, they have tables which the scribes have written down. Some of these still survive. This is how we know about it. Showing how to write more complicated fractions in terms of these Egyptian fractions, these 1/over something. So they did it completely differently. So the actual history of the number system takes several thousand years to develop. And what we now think of as something that is so basic and straightforward that, you know, it must have been around forever. Even if you go back more than about 300 years, you start to see some differences in exactly how they wrote things and the way they did things. If you go back more than 1,000 years, a lot of this stuff just doesn't exist at all.
So, and I realize this is probably a really big question, but I just have to ask, what are numbers really? We use them all the time, but what are they actually?
You know, mathematicians finally wrote down a definition of what a number is about 120 years ago, round about then. We all know what 2 cows or 2 pigs or 2 pencils or whatever are. But if somebody says, what's 2? Well, then we write down the symbol. I say, no, that's just the symbol for 2. That isn't 2. That's just how you write it. And the way eventually mathematicians sorted it out was basically numbers are standard objects used to count things. So I can do it in a fairly concrete way. If you take a child to a field and there are cows there, they sort of point at the cows and go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Okay, there are 5 cows. So 5 is a label for the process that gives you 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. It's a standard name for any collection that matches that particular setup. So if there were 5 sheep in another field, you could count them 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Then what matters, you can kind of throw away the numbers and just say, look, if I've got some sheep in one field and some cows in the other field, and for every sheep, I can find 1 cow, and for every cow, there's exactly 1 sheep, and I can just pair them off. then the number of cows is the same as the number of sheep, without actually saying what that number is.
Right.
If you're at a dinner and everyone has got a cup and a saucer in front of them, mm-hmm. you know that the number of cups is equal to the number of saucers, without right. knowing how many it is.
Exactly.
Yeah. So what the mathematicians did was invent set theory, which is a mathematical description of collections of objects. And they said the most important thing about a set is how many things it contains, but we'll get at that indirectly. The first thing we'll do is just define what we mean by two sets containing the same number of things. They are equinumerous, mm-hmm. avoiding the word number. And then we just concoct some standard list of mathematical objects which will correspond to 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, and so on. So numbers are a kind of abstraction from the idea of counting, but more importantly, the idea of matching up two different collections and showing that you can pair them off exactly so that each element of one collection matches exactly one element in the other one.
Now, the role of counting is part of the fundamental basis for numbers. I believe that led to the discovery of different sizes of infinity. Is that correct?
That is absolutely correct. I mean, there's a German called Georg Cantor. And Cantor is the person who not only took the business of matching things up, matching sets up seriously. Several mathematicians previously had thought of that, and a chap called Frege also thought of that. But Cantor said, I wonder what happens if we have not just finitely many, 1, 2, 3, 4, the standard numbers. Suppose you've got infinitely many mathematical objects. Can't we count them as well by this same idea that if I can match two sets, two collections to each other in a one-to-one manner, then whatever number means, they have the same number of members. And so the first thing he realized was very funny things happen here. The number of even integers is the same as the number of all integers. The integers are the counting numbers, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and so forth, and the even ones are 2, 4, 6, 8, 10. So the even ones are actually only a part of all of the integers, yeah?
Right.
So normally you'd think, well, if you have a collection that's a part of another collection, then the second one is bigger. It's got more numbers in it.
Right.
It's got, you know, if you're at a party and there's a small group of people in the corner and there's some other people in the room, you know immediately there are more people in the room than there are in the small group in the corner.
Of course, yeah.
But with an infinite party, it doesn't work like that. So stuck in the corner are all the even numbers, 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, and so on. And the odd numbers are also there, but if you pair up every integer with twice that integer, so one matches with 2, 2 matches with 4, 3 mm-hmm. matches with 6, 4 matches with 8, mm-hmm. 5 with 10, and so on, then every integer is matched to an even number, and every even number is matched to an integer, namely half that even number, and there are none missing. So in terms of these counting infinities that Cantor was inventing, those two collections should have the same number of members. So in order to count infinite sets, you have to throw away some of the familiar properties of finite sets. So the idea that the whole is greater than the part is not true in terms of counting infinite sets. Then the wonderful thing that Cantor then discovered is there are different sizes of infinity. Some infinite sets, by this method of counting, are genuinely bigger than others. The set of all real numbers, of all decimals that go on forever, like pi.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, pi just goes on, never stops.
Right.
Think of all the possible numbers you could make by having decimal digits that go on forever and don't stop. That collection of numbers cannot be matched in a one-to-one way with 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 going on forever.
Right.
It doesn't matter what you do, you cannot match them up. So there are genuinely more of these infinite decimals than there are of the integers. And at the time Cantor did this, most of the mathematicians looked at this stuff and said, this chap's crazy. I mean, he did actually have some slight mental problems at one point, but he wasn't crazy at all. Some of the really, really good mathematicians got it. And there was a big argument between probably some of the old fuddy-duddies who thought this Cantor stuff was just this sort of abstract nonsense and didn't mean anything, and the brighter young mathematicians who thought, hey, actually, this is very, very interesting, and I think he's right. So there's an interesting period towards the end of the 1800s when it's quite controversial, this whole idea. But by 1920 or so, it basically has been accepted by virtually all mathematicians. There are some who have a slightly different way of thinking about mathematical logic, who say, oh, this is very, very clever, but it doesn't really mean anything. But everybody else says it's very, very clever, and it does mean something.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, hosted by Rochelle Saunders. Today we're talking about numbers real and complex with University of Warwick Professor of Mathematics Ian Stewart in the second of our two-part series on math. Last week we spoke to applied mathematician Malcolm Roberts about his field of fluid dynamics. And if you missed it, you can visit Skeptically Speaking on iTunes to download last week's show. And we'll be back to the interview after this.
Skeptically Speaking wants you to question everything. To be a part of the discussion, call and record your question on our listener question line at Speak 73101. That's 773-257-3101. Long-distance charges may apply. Sunday nights at 6 Mountain Time, join our Ustream chat room to listen and ask questions as we record interviews live. Just click the Listen Online button at skepticallyspeaking.com. You can also email your questions and comments to live@skepticallyspeaking.com. Or if you're on Twitter, tweet us at Skeptical Radio. To find out where Skeptically Speaking airs near you, to listen to past episodes, or download the weekly podcast, check out our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, follow the links to connect with us on our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, or to subscribe to the show in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking, hosted today by Rochelle Saunders, standing in for regular host Desiree Schell, who will be back next week. Today I'm here with Ian Stewart, professor of mathematics at the University of Warwick in the UK and author of a literal library shelf full of math and science books. We're discussing the fundamentals and language of math. So we've actually had a few chat room questions already, and I want to make sure we don't miss them. So the first one here is from Marie Claire.
In science, we often talk about using cutting-edge research topics to stimulate feelings of wonder and interest in young students. What ideas or topics do you think could do that for mathematics?
There are some which are quite tried and tested over the last 20 or 30 years, which definitely do have this effect. Fractal geometry is one of these. Benoit Mandelbrot invented shapes that he calls fractals, the idea of a fractal. So a fractal is something that repeats the same form on many different scales. If you look at little pieces of it, they look just like the big pieces. A very familiar example is a fern. If you look at a fern leaf, it's basically made up of lots of smaller fern leaves stuck along the central stalk. And there are many, many shapes of this kind. The geometry is very beautiful. There's wonderful computer graphics. And these fractals do have some very interesting applications to the natural world. So this is something that I know quite a lot of school teachers do use to try and get students interested. Another piece of cutting-edge math that is pretty well known now is chaos theory. The idea that even if you know the mathematical rules for some system, and those rules have no random features at all, they absolutely prescribe exactly what it is going to do, and it's some sort of system that changes over time, it's a dynamical system, you can have very simple rules, but extraordinarily complicated behavior in the actual system. And it's so complicated that in certain respects, it is exactly the same as a random system. So you have this kind of paradox that deterministic rules with no random content can nonetheless lead to random behavior. And this, again, has had a big influence on the development of science, and it's a very fascinating area. And it's one of those areas where you can, although this is frontier math research, it is possible to get some idea of what it's about and have some understanding of it without actually being a research mathematician yourself.
That's interesting. I found one of the things that sometimes trips me up when I'm reading about math is actually the language of mathematics. It's often the most challenging thing for me to wrap my head around as a layperson. One of the ones that frequently trips me up is the use of the word dimension in mathematics.
Mathematicians are rather naughty, actually. They take words that we all use and they have a very familiar meaning and we all know what it is. And they say, we're going to use that in a slightly different way. So dimension, in the sense we're talking about, a flat piece of paper is two-dimensional, space is three-dimensional. That's the basic point here.
Right.
Yeah. And if you want to go the other way, a line is a one-dimensional object and a point is a naught-dimensional, zero-dimensional object.
Right.
What about four dimensions? Well, that's kind of hard to visualize. And for a long time, people said it doesn't exist. The mathematician said, well, you know, if you actually look at what you mean when you say that a piece of paper is two-dimensional, what you mean is that if you put two axes at right angles to each other, sort of horizontal and a vertical one, and you measure a distance in the horizontal direction and then a distance in the vertical direction, you get a single point on your piece of paper is prescribed. It's like a piece of graph paper. So two numbers tell you where a point is, how far you go from left to right, how far you go up and down. So if I say go three steps to the right, two steps up, you know exactly which point you've got on a sheet of paper in the plane in two dimensions.
Right.
Now in three dimensions, you need a third number. So north, south, east, west, up, down. So two-dimensional space uses two numbers, three-dimensional space uses three numbers. So the mathematicians say, oh, well, so if you need four numbers for something, then that we'll call that a four-dimensional space. And you say, well, can you show me one? And we say, well, in the abstract, just consider lists of four numbers, right?
Right.
Let's just go for the jugular and come up with the object that we want to talk about. But they started to realize that if you start thinking about how many numbers you need to specify some particular object, then you often need more than three.
Mm-hmm.
So if you think about squares on a sheet of paper, instead of points, squares. Now, a square has a definite size. That's one number. It's tilted at some angle.
Mm-hmm.
It may not be horizontal vertical, it might be a tilted square, that's a second number. And then one of the corners, you can move that square to any position on your sheet of paper. So you need two more numbers to say where one of the corners is.
Right.
So the collection of all squares on a sheet of paper needs four numbers to actually specify any member of that collection. So it's a four-dimensional space. This is what mathematicians say. So what's happened here is that the familiar word has been extended, the meaning of dimension has been slightly changed, but in the familiar cases, it still gives the same answer as the old meaning. But there are now some new uses, four dimensions, five dimensions, six, seven, eight, where there wasn't an old meaning.
Mm-hmm.
When mathematicians do that, at least you know that when you're in the familiar situation, it's still the same word. It still means the same thing. But they also have this habit of just taking standard words out of the language, like rank, group, cycle. You know, if I say cycle, everyone thinks of a bicycle, but a mathematician's cycle is a completely different thing.
Right.
So they take familiar words and use them with just a totally new meaning. And the reason for that, basically, is you need a word for it, and sometimes they try to find something that kind of hints at what the mathematical structure is. So a mathematical cycle is something that kind of goes round and round and round, and the head joins to the tail in some sense. And in fact, there are several different meanings of cycle in mathematics, but they all have that structure. So the name reminds you. You know, and you either have very, very fancy jargon names, and there's plenty of them as well. In algebraic topology, there's things like homotopy, homology, cobordism, all sorts of funny names that are just kind of made up, usually from the Latin.
Mm-hmm.
And it sounds terribly, terribly impressive, but it doesn't sound as if it's anything that, it doesn't sound very friendly.
Right.
But particularly in recent years, mathematicians have tended to use friendly names for things, even if the concept they're talking about is not at all friendly. It's just easier than, you know, you could just invent completely crazy words. Sometimes they do. There's a mathematician called John Horton Conway who invented the word threckle to describe some mathematical object. What is a threckle? It's the object that Conway described. This is not a word that you normally find, maybe in some obscure dialect, I don't really know, but it's not a word we use every day.
It sounds a bit Dr. Seussian, actually.
It does, doesn't it? Yes. Well, Dr. Seuss is there's some interesting mathematics in some of Seuss, yes.
Really?
He one fish, two fish, red fish, blue fish. He's trying to teach kids to count to some extent there. So,
right.
So
I have another question from the chat room from Bytor.
Given their utility, are non-decimal bases used in mathematics these days anywhere other than binary, octal, and hexadecimal in computing?
There is some use of base 3 in some areas of mathematics, particularly in dynamical systems, but only to describe particular mathematical objects that are of interest. So in various bits of pure math, in theoretical math, you may actually find almost any number base being used temporarily to describe a particular structure that's of interest. There are even, I did some work a while ago with a student of mine, which involved having different bases at each step in the number. So the first digit was base 2, let's say. The next digit was base 7. The next digit was base 9. The next digit was base 5, and so on. But for computational purposes, practical purposes, as was said there, computers use various things to do with base 2 because that's very natural for the way the computer logic circuits work. And we use base 10. And that really is about all that goes on, with the exception of various, our system for hours, minutes, seconds, you know, 7 days in a week, 24 hours in a day, 60 minutes in an hour, 60 seconds in a minute, you've got a mixed base there of 7, 24, 60, and 60.
Right.
So there's a few things like that, but I think in the spirit in which the question was asked, the answer is no, basically.
Well, okay then.
Yep.
I also want to talk about the idea of abstraction, which comes up quite a lot in mathematics. What are we actually doing when we abstract something?
What we're doing is we are taking a number of examples that have something in common and then coming up with a statement of what it is they have in common and considering those objects to be examples of that structure. So you abstract is a verb. You abstract a concept from concrete examples.
Okay.
Yeah. So, even familiar things like triangle are in a sense an abstraction because how do you show somebody what a triangle is? How do we learn? Well, you draw a triangle. That's a triangle. Well, that's only one triangle. That's one object.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And you draw another one. And you draw another one. And you say, now, these have all got something in common. And we can ask children to work out what it is. We can tell them it's got three sides. So anything that has three sides is in a sense an abstraction from the three particular triangles, three or four triangles that you've drawn. But it's still a pretty concrete object. You give one example, you say, well, it's anything that looks like this. So that the kind of abstract structures that come up in more advanced mathematics are definitely something that they sound rather vague when you describe them. There's one that's called a group.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, group, it's nice sounding. Sounds like something fairly simple. In a sense, it is. But the concrete examples of a group are things like, take all the whole numbers, positive and negative,
mm-hmm.
and add them together. So you have a collection of numbers and an operation of addition.
Okay.
Okay. Now, that is an example of a group. Another one would be something quite different. You consider, you take a circle and you rotate it through different angles.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have the set of all rotations of the circle, And instead of adding them together, what you do is rotate through some angle and then rotate again through another angle. So you compose the rotations by doing them in turn. Now, those two structures have a certain amount in common, even though they're completely different things. What they are is some collection of mathematical objects and some operation which will combine two of them together to give another one. And then you actually write down there are three or four properties that you want this operation to have. There's something like a zero, which when you add it to things doesn't make any difference.
Mm-hmm.
Everything has something like a negative, which when you add the two together you get zero. For the rotations of the circle, don't rotate it at all is like zero. And rotation through some angle clockwise, the negative of that is rotation counterclockwise through the same angle.
Right.
And there are just hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of different examples of this group structure. Each one of them is something, if you shuffle cards, each shuffle rearranges the cards, and I can perform two shuffles in turn to get a third shuffle. That's
right.
Another group.
Okay.
Yeah?
Yeah?
So we've got numbers, we've got rotations, we've got shuffles. They are all groups. But what the mathematicians do is abstract this property, and so you could actually, sometimes they do this, but I think it's a bit naughty, you could actually just start by saying, okay, I'm going to tell you what a group is. A group is a collection of objects together with an operation that takes any two objects and combines them to give another one, such that the following four properties are satisfied. Stop. And if you did that to someone who'd never seen any of these things before, they'd look at it and say, what the heck is that? But if you've seen some examples, and if you've done a bit of playing around with those examples, you start to realize there's certain things they have in common. And it makes an awful lot. Instead of having 14 different examples of a group and 14 different calculations for each special case, which all basically are telling you the same thing,
mm-hmm.
why not do it once for the abstract structure and then say, okay, because it's true for the abstract general structure, it will be true for every example that you can invent. So it makes it's much more efficient, in fact, to work with the abstract general structure, because you prove some mathematical theorem which says any group with certain properties will do other things. If a group is of has a particular structure, then some other behavior will occur. Now, once you prove that in the general case, you can apply it to every example. Say, what does that tell us about the integers? What does that tell us about rotations? What does that tell us about shuffles? So, for example, if the group has finitely many objects in it, then if you take an object and combine it with itself and just keep going, eventually you will get back to the object you started with. If I rotate through a right angle, second right angle, third right angle, fourth right angle, fifth right angle, I'm back to where I started.
Right.
Yeah? So yeah. Four right angles, getting back to the beginning. Five right angles is the same as one.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, the shuffles of a card pack, actually, that's a finite collection. It's a rather large number of shuffles, but nonetheless it's finite. So this is, if you have a fixed way of shuffling cards, such as the standard riffle shuffle, where you split the pack in half and interleave them, alternately all the way down the two halves.
Right.
If you keep repeating that, you will eventually get the cards back into the original order.
Right.
Now, that's not so obvious. And in fact, if you tried it, it would take quite a long time to get it back. But the abstract theorem that says in any finite group, if you take a particular element and combine it with itself enough times, you get back to the original element, that tells us that this property of shuffling of cards must be true. And then you could sit down and actually do the sums and work out how many times you have to do it and so on. It's quite interesting. But it means you can unshuffle a pack just by repeatedly shuffling it.
So when we talk about a certain mathematical theorem or proof being elegant, what are we actually saying? What does elegance mean?
I think what elegant means is, one, I see how it works. Two, that's really rather clever, isn't it? Three, somehow you feel it's got to the heart of the problem. My favorite example of a simple, elegant proof there is a puzzle about a chessboard and dominoes. So take a chessboard and assume you've got a collection of dominoes. So a domino is like two squares stuck together, and assume those squares are the same size as the chessboard squares, so that a domino will cover exactly two of the chessboard squares. Okay?
Right.
Now, suppose I cut out two corner squares from the chessboard, which are opposite, diagonally opposite to each other.
Okay.
Okay? So you cut out two diagonally opposite squares. So now you've got a chessboard with two little bits nibbled out in opposite corners.
Mm-hmm.
Is it possible to tile that hacked chessboard with dominoes so that the dominoes don't overlap and don't leave any gaps? And you can try it, and if you try it, you find that you get almost all the way tiling this chessboard, and then maybe there's only two squares left, but they're not next to each other, and you can't fit a tile in. And you keep trying, and you never seem to be able to do it. But that's not a proof. There are literally billions and billions and quadrillions of ways you could tile the chessboard, so that you just can't do it by listing all the possible ways and seeing that they don't work.
Mm-hmm.
But if you observe that, firstly, the diagonally opposite squares on a chessboard both have the same colour. They're either both white or both black, depending which pair you've chosen.
Right.
So a chessboard has 32 black, 32 white squares, and suppose we've taken two white squares away. Well, it's got 32 black and 30 white. When you put a domino on a chessboard, it always covers one black and one white.
Mm-hmm.
So if I could tile the chessboard with dominoes, the number of black squares would have to equal the number of white squares.
Right.
Each domino has one of each. Yeah, and the little light bulb goes off.
Aha.
For the full chessboard, that's not a problem. But if you've taken two white squares away,
then you have two
you've
black
got
squares
two
left.
Extra black squares you can't get rid of. Now, that's an elegant proof. There's a clever idea. Look at the colours that the domino is covering and count. There are two ideas. The second idea, count the number of squares.
Mm-hmm.
Put those together, and now suddenly you cut through this enormous, complicated mass of, well, I could put one in the corner in a horizontal position or one in the vertical position, and the next one could go, oh, my Lord, and there's millions and millions and millions of these. I don't see how to handle this.
Right.
You cut all the way through that nonsense and say, it doesn't matter. Just imagine you've done it and count the black and white squares. And that does it. So that's an elegant proof.
This is Skeptically Speaking, hosted today by Rochelle Saunders. Today we're talking about pure mathematics with University of Warwick professor and author Ian Stewart, about his work and the wide applications of pure math to science. And we'll be right back after this.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, we're looking into what happens in our brains when we're experiencing some of the most powerful feelings we feel. We'll spend the hour with science writer Kate Sukel to talk about her book Dirty Minds, How Our Brains Influence Love, Sex, and Relationships. From pheromones to fMRI, it's an entertaining and informative look at the neuroscience of affection. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking, on your local radio station, or online at skepticallyspeaking.com.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm Rochelle Saunders, standing in for regular host Desiree Schell, during this, the second of our two-part series on mathematics. Today we're here with Professor Ian Stewart of the University of Warwick, mathematician and prolific author of books such as Professor Stewart's Cabinet of Mathematical Curiosities, Why Beauty is Truth, A History of Symmetry, and Evolving the Alien, The Science of Extraterrestrial Life. Now, you've actually teamed up with a biologist before to write several books, including The Collapse of Chaos, Figments of Reality, Evolving the Alien, and also the Science of the Discworld series.
Yes.
So how did your collaboration with biologist Jack Cohen come about?
22 years ago, Jack phoned me. I'd never met him. I was at the University of Warwick. He was at the University of Birmingham, which is 30 miles away. I was a mathematician. He was a biologist, and particularly in those days, those two subjects didn't interact a great deal. There was some interaction, but not a lot. But I was sitting in my office at the university, and the telephone rang, and the voice on the other said, "Hello, my name is Jack Cohen. I'm a biologist at Birmingham. I've just read one of your books about chaos theory. Can I come and talk to you? Because I think it has some there's some interesting questions about biology." And biology doesn't actually seem to quite work like that. So I thought, oh, okay, this is interesting. So he came over and we went out to the local pub for lunch, and we 4 hours later we were still in the pub talking. And what we began to realize was that although mathematics and biology have very little in common as regards the content or even the way that the people doing the research think, on an obvious level, as soon as you start getting to a slightly more subtle or deeper level, suddenly the two subjects have an awful lot in common. From simple things like, how do you get your students to understand what you're talking about, through to sort of fairly specific research questions, about whether something in biology is stable or not. You know, there are all sorts of interesting, a lot of people are interested in whether the ecosystems are stable in the sense that they will keep going and without changing too much. And this is kind of mathematical concept, stability. So Jack and I just started meeting up and talking to each other about once a week. He was a very interesting biologist because most of his colleagues were molecular biologists. They were doing DNA and proteins and things like that, which was very fashionable at that point and still is, and very important. But Jack was the sort of biologist who actually thought it had something to do with animals. So Jack at that point owned a plot of about 6 or 7 acres of land, and he had 3 sheep, a donkey, 2 llamas, he had a whole pile of chickens, some guinea fowl. In the house he had an area which had frogs and lizards and tortoises. He had animals. He thought biology was about animals. So I used to go and visit him and feed polo mints to the sheep and things like that. And we just sort of kind of got to know each other. And after several years of this kind of discussion, we looked at each other one day and said, you know, there's a book in all this. We should just put all this stuff together. And so we wrote a book, The Collapse of Chaos, it was called, which was actually the question he'd asked me on the very first day. And the question was, if a lot of dynamical systems can be chaotic and random, how come biology works at all? Because things like reproduction in biology, you know, 2 rabbits have to create another rabbit, not something random. Mm-hmm. So Jack and I were trying to, what is it that makes, how does biology avoid or deal with chaos? And the answer we came up with was it doesn't avoid it, it collapses it. It kind of squeezes the chaos out of the system by arranging itself so that the chaos doesn't do too much damage. And so that was kind of the point of this book. And then we had so much fun doing that. We then started writing various other things together.
Now, I've always been a big Terry Pratchett fan, and about 5 or 6 years ago, I picked up the Science of the Discworld books just sort of as another Pratchett book to read, which you and Jack Cohen actually helped write. And in them are some of the best explanations of science and math concepts that I've read, which I actually credit somewhat for bringing me back around to the science and math are cool camp.
Those are wonderful books. We're about to start a fourth one, in fact.
Oh.
But what happened was there was a book called The Physics of Star Trek. And what it did was it used things like faster-than-light travel in Star Trek as a way to discuss what we know in physics about faster-than-light travel. And Jack and I wondered whether it was possible to do a book like that about Discworld. Jack had known Terry Pratchett since before he started writing his Discworld books, before he was famous. Jack was a science fiction fan. Terry was a science fiction fan. In fact, I was a science fiction fan. And so, again, back in 1990, Jack introduced me to Terry. By that time, Terry was famous, but he'd come along to a science fiction convention just for the fun of it. He wasn't giving a talk. He wanted to go back to his roots as a fan. And the three of us got on together, so we met up from time to time. So anyway, so Jack and I went to Terry and said, Terry, why don't we do a book like Physics of Star Trek, but about Discworld? Let's explain the science behind things in Discworld. And Terry said, I'd love to do a book like that, but there isn't any science in this world. It runs on magic.
Right.
It's all about wizards and witches, and the this world is flat because worlds should be flat. It's about magic and the power of story. It's not about science. And we said, oh, but there's lots of science jokes, like the cat in the box that can, it's not just alive or dead. It can be also absolutely bloody furious. So, you know, it's quantum mechanics, isn't it? He said, yes, but you can't really write a book about that sort of thing.
Right.
So we thought, oh dear, well, it's not going to work. And then about 6 months later, Jack and I were talking, and we suddenly had an idea. So we phoned up Terry and said, Terry, if there's no science in Discworld, could we persuade you to put some there? So we came up with a scenario, which is Terry wrote a Discworld short story about the Round World Project. And the Round World Project is a magical containment field. It's about the size of a football in Discworld, but inside, because there is no power of story, it doesn't know what size it ought to be, so it can be as big as you like. And our universe is inside this Round World thing,
right,
which is a magical containment field that keeps the magic out, which means that inside it something else has to happen. So what happens inside is our universe, which we can explain by science. So then Terry wrote this story, and we chopped it up into about a dozen pieces. And in between each of those pieces, we inserted a chapter on the real science of the real round world, which is going on inside this round world invented by the Discworld wizards. And the wizards, of course, are terribly puzzled by everything that's happening because it doesn't work the way Discworld does. For a start, the planets are round, not flat.
Right.
So they look at it and think, well, that's a stupid way to make a planet. Things will fall off. Oh, no, no, no. There's this thing called gravity which holds stuff on. Oh, yeah, I suppose. And so we have a lot of fun. Basically, our universe is completely crazy and things are not made the way you would expect them to be. Whereas this world is sensible. It's flat, so things don't fall off. It's held up by four elephants to make sure it doesn't fall. The elephants sit on the back of a giant turtle because something's got to hold elephants up. Turtles don't need to be held up. They can swim.
Right.
Yeah, and so it all went from there.
So we actually had this question emailed in last week when we talked to Malcolm Roberts, but I wanted to ask you as well. For those of us who want to keep up with modern science news, it seems like we also have to keep up with mathematics as well, since many new areas of science are increasingly reliant on higher level math. What's the best way for the enthusiastic layperson to keep up?
At the moment, the best way to keep up is, in fact, to read popular mathematics books. I'm not particularly trying to promote, you know, I write a lot of these, but the great thing about a popular math book is that you get a well-defined, well-presented chunk of material, and in book length, it's possible for the writer to actually take a fairly gentle path through the material, so it doesn't get too complicated. It's something that you can work your way through, read almost the way you would read a novel.
Right.
And what this does is just gives you a feeling for some of the interesting new areas, or for the history of the subject where it came from, or for what it's good for, or what the people themselves are like. You know, there are many levels on which to do this. But I think that's actually one of the best ways. There are some TV programs about math. And, of course, there are one or two very long-running series, particularly for the more elementary kind of stuff. But if you want to get to the advanced stuff, there are some documentaries. Marcus du Sautoy in the UK has made quite a few television programs about advanced mathematics. But these are my wife, who is a nurse and who is not a great fan of mathematics, to be frank. She's okay at it, but she's never greatly. She wanted to help people get well rather than learn math, and discovered she needed some math to do that. But she watched Marcus's programs and said, yeah, I enjoyed that, and I kind of understood that. So you can keep an eye open for, I'm sure that they must be available. If they're not available on the television, they you can often find them on the internet. I did, years ago, a series of Christmas lectures for young people on mathematics, which were 1-hour lectures done with lots of demonstrations with an audience of about 500 children between the ages of about 12 and 18 mm-hmm. for BBC television. And you can find those on the web. They're available from the Royal Institution website, free.
Okay.
And they covered, we did Chaos, we did Fractals, we did Symmetry, we did Probability. For the Symmetry program, it's the only time I've ever done this, started the lecture by bringing a live tiger into the lecture room.
Wow.
Yeah. She was 6 months old, but a six-month-old tigress is
still a tiger.
Still a tiger. And so I was doing the Tiger, Tiger, Burning Bright, Fearful Symmetry poem to start it, William Blake.
Right.
And television being television, if I'm talking about tigers, we ought to have one. And in fact, it was Jack Cohen, with his biology and animal contacts, who found us a media-savvy tiger. But when the tigress came into the lecture room with two burly young men and on the end of a chain, mind you, you could hear a pin drop. The audience went completely silent. They'd been warned this was going to happen in case some were scared of it, and we'd arranged things so that the front row of seats protected the audience from the tiger. The only person who was not protected from the tiger was me. And the two young men who were hanging on to the other end of the chain.
Right.
That was all right. And in some ways, that was the high point of my lecturing career, and I've never been able to repeat this. But you can find this material on the web, and there are many other things like this. So I think those are actually, at the moment, the two best ways. Look for television documentaries or similar things, but very much, there are a lot of excellent popular maths books nowadays. I know because I now have a lot of competition. So I write these from time to time, but there are many, many people who are writing really good. As soon as some important new bit of math is done nowadays, someone's written a book about it for the layperson, for the non-specialist reader.
So what made you decide to write your first book for a layman audience?
I think I'm a little bit of a mathematical evangelist. Not only did I love mathematics, but I wanted everyone else to love it, and I could see that they didn't. And I thought, if only someone would tell them how wonderful it is. So I had a kind of journalistic urge. Yeah, not so much evangelistic in the sense I didn't actually want to convert them to mathematics, but I wanted to put it out there so that if they were interested, then they'd be able to find things. Because when I was a kid, this was the sort of book I wanted to read, and there weren't many of them.
Right.
So I just kind of, in various ways, drifted into it. One of the things that got me involved in it was I started writing the Scientific American Mathematical Games column. Martin Gardner, who's very, very famous among mathematicians as much as anybody, he wasn't a mathematician, but he wrote wonderful columns for years and years and years in Scientific American magazine about making mathematics fun, but he actually took some very serious mathematics and presented it in a way that in the context of a game or a puzzle or something of this kind, just something that made it more attractive and friendly. And when he stopped writing this, a couple of other people did it for a while, but through a rather long chain of coincidences, which I won't relate to you, I ended up doing it for about 10 years. Now, so once a month, I was writing two or three pages for the magazine about mathematics for non-specialists. So that was a kind of, that was very good training. And it was really after I'd done that that I started to seriously write regular popular maths books. I do at least one a year these days, sometimes two. I do it because I'm that sort of person, and I can't stop myself doing it.
Well, that is an excellent reason. Ian, it has been an absolute pleasure having you on the show today. Thank you so much for being here.
It's been delightful talking to you, Rochelle.
If you want to learn more about Ian Stewart and where to find his books, there will be links posted in the show notes on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. And while you're there, we'd love for you to also click on the links to visit our Facebook page, our Google Plus feed, and our Twitter feed, where you can get the latest Skeptically Speaking news and updates. You can also visit Skeptically Speaking on iTunes, where you can download all of our past episodes, subscribe to receive future shows, or leave a review. Thanks for listening to Skeptically Speaking.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is. 'Cause we're skeptically speaking.